Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. I am your host, Guy Swan, and I want to start today's episode off by talking about there is a donation page on 10hoursofbitcoin.com. Some of you may actually be here because of 10hoursofbitcoin.com. I've read four of the pieces on that website. If you don't know what 10hoursofbitcoin.com is, it's run by J.W. Weatherman, and I think Rollo McFlugel does that one as well. I think that's a joint thing from them. I could be wrong about that. But it's literally like just a solid introduction of all the main pieces of understanding Bitcoin for like shelling out that I read on the show, money blockchains and social scalability, like a couple different Szabo pieces, and then he's got his human threat model and Bitcoin threat model. He's got a couple pieces on the Lightning Network. I think there's the Bitcoin Standard prologue to the Saifedean's book, et cetera, et cetera. There's a bunch of great stuff up there. So if you haven't checked that website out, definitely do. But he runs donations. They have like a donations page up there that they're trying to raise for certain projects in Bitcoin. And right now, they're trying to raise money for a wiki on people who have in the past attacked Bitcoin or ran some FUD campaign against Bitcoin. You know, Roger Ver, Voorhees, and everybody with SegWit2x and stuff. Like these, like a lot of people, like they're still very prominent people in the space, and people who are coming in very often do not know the history or cannot get accurate versions of that history. Like the fact that they supported SegWit2x and were blindly going to push for it against the will of the community and against the consideration and advisement of literally all of the sensible developers, save for like one who was the main developer on the SegWit2x project, and then S2X completely failed. And a lot of them were just like, let's just push this under the rug and not talk about it anymore, so that I don't ever have to answer for the fact that I almost caused the worst bug in the history of Bitcoin by forcing everybody to do something and saying that we controlled Bitcoin when that's just not the case. That's not a small f*** up. Like, it's just not. And the fact that a huge portion of those people have just not apologized, they've made no statement saying, like, I was wrong, like, this was a bad idea, we didn't actually even hire anybody to review the code, and we were going to try to deploy this on an investment from millions of people who are incredibly passionate about this, and we did not care if we screwed it up for them because we were concerned with ourselves. Like, that didn't happen. So this will be a really, really nice wiki to have for the people who don't know that story took place. So I'm going to be donating a little bit of money to that. They had just raised donations for me for the audio that I contributed to 10 Hours of Bitcoin. So I'm happy to throw a little bit of that back for a bounty to get that wiki built out. Very, very interesting to see what comes of that. Okay, so don't forget to check that out. And if you can donate, if you have a little bit to donate, please throw a few dollars that way so that because I think that's a very worthwhile project. For today's episode, oh, man, you know, before we got one more thing to cover, I have been considering a rebrand of the show. Anybody who has been here for a long time or for any number of episodes really knows that I am very Bitcoin-centric. And everything that I read or cover, even if it's about altcoins or some alternative, proof system or privacy system, anything like that, it's almost universally in relation to how it affects Bitcoin or what it means for Bitcoin and the you know, crypto economy at large. But I've been considering, because crypto economy kind of sounds like I'm talking about altcoins and all the blockchain and DLT, it kind of sounds like it doesn't lead people to believe that I am a Bitcoin podcast, and I am a Bitcoin podcast. So I would really love your guys' input into that decision. I don't want to do it. I don't think rebranding is a giant risk, but at the same time, I don't want to do it just because, I'm getting bored with an old name and want to try something new. Like, if I rebrand, this will be the last time, I will be stuck with the next name. And in that same vein, I also have just been I've been unable to stop thinking about it for the last 2 months, so I want to make a solid decision on it. So I have a poll up on my Twitter that's at TheCryptoEconomy. So if you could weigh in on that with a comment and vote on that, I have no idea if I'm even going to follow the vote. It seems to be like it's just 50-50, and it's been like bouncing back and forth a little bit. So it might not even help me make a decision, but I would still very much like to hear what you guys think. Should I be more Bitcoin-centric? Should I rebrand? Do you like the crypto economy name? Do you think I could benefit from something new, more focused on Bitcoin? Okay. With that out of the way, let's go ahead and jump into today's quick read, because it's going to be a fun one. I think I'm going to do an economics week. I've got a couple of things lined up that I think are going to be really awesome discussions of stuff that a lot of people just haven't heard. And I hope to really challenge this week with a couple of the pieces that we're reading, and possibly a guy's take as well. Some of the dominant economic thought out there that's just kind of the default that people just don't stop and question. So I think this is going to be a fun week, and we are starting with one by Connor Brown. And a thank you to Saifedean for retweeting this out recently, because I had actually had this in my list. He had actually sent me a message asking if he could get my input on the article. And I read it, and it's a topic that I've always been interested in, but it just got lost in my list. This happens constantly. If I collect 1,000 different articles, it's not really any easier to find it in my list than it is on Google or Twitter. So I appreciate Saifedean for retweeting this out, because I had completely forgotten about this one. And it was actually one that I did want to hit on the show. So it is called Bitcoin Has No Intrinsic Value, and That's Great. And we're going to talk about Mises regression theorem. We're going to talk about what the value of money is. It's going to be fun. So I can't wait. Let's go ahead and jump right in without any further ado. Bitcoin Has No Intrinsic Value, and That's Great, by Connor Brown. Intrinsic value. Bitcoin skeptics love to talk about it. Their argument is typically as follows. Quote, Bitcoin cannot be used as a money because it does not have any intrinsic value as a commodity. For something to be a viable money, it must first be accepted and used for some other commodity purpose intrinsic to the item, then slowly become a money over time. For example, because gold can be used in jewelry and electronics, people naturally stockpile it to store value. End quote. Previously, Bitcoiners have made several compelling arguments against this on the grounds that 1. Intrinsic value is subjective, and 2. Bitcoin does have intrinsic value as a good for censorship-resistant payments. Here, I will argue that Bitcoin skeptics are right. Bitcoin has no intrinsic value as a commodity, but that's a great thing for Bitcoin and the rest of the world. Inside the mind of a skeptic. Intrinsic value is an old idea. Even Aristotle wrote about the importance of money being, quote, intrinsically useful and easily applicable to the purposes of life, for example, iron, silver, and the like. It's no wonder that this idea has persisted. Commodity value has been essential to humankind for thousands of years and is directly evident to the layman. Despite its ancient origins, intrinsic value is not directly linked to monetary functions. A good money needs to be many things: portable and easy to trade, scarce and durable to store value, fungible and divisible as a unit of account, but an alternative commodity use is not one of them. So why do many critics claim money needs intrinsic commodity value? There appear to be two main reasons. Appeals to history. Many skeptics denounce Bitcoin's lack of intrinsic value simply because they are accustomed to stores of value doubling as commodities. Put simply, they are living in the past. Many have made this argument about previous technological improvements by wrongly assuming that previous trends would hold true. The fact that all previous forms of value had a physical form does not mean a new store of value must also be physical. People were making similar arguments about physical shopping during the rise of the internet. Here is a hilariously bad take from a Newsweek contributor in the 90s, arguing that because we've always had physical sales in the past, physical sales will not be replaced by the internet. Bitcoin skeptics claiming money needs to be a useful physical commodity will seem equally ridiculous a decade from now. In fact, history shows that commodity value is far from a requirement for a money. Nick Szabo explains in the beginning of his classic piece, Shelling Out, The Origins of Money, that societies have used otherwise, quote, useless items for storing and communicating value. These glass beads had many strong monetary properties and were used for trading throughout Africa and parts of North America, but they had little use as a commodity. The rhinestones used by the Yap people are another example of a store of value without commodity use. Figure 1, glass beads formerly used as money among tribes in Oklahoma. Appeals to authority. Today, many who voice concerns about intrinsic commodity value trace their arguments to Austrian economists such as Menger, Mises, and Rothbard. These writers strongly emphasize the importance of money and its impacts on society. For them, commodity value and money have been inseparable since their earliest writings. One of Menger's seminal works on the origins of money begins by describing money as, quote, the fact of certain commodities becoming universally acceptable media of exchange, end quote. Mises later built upon this understanding. In The Theory of Money and Credit, Mises writes, quote, we may give the name commodity money to that sort of money that is at the same time a commercial commodity, and the name fiat money to money that comprises things with a special legal qualification. End quote. Following in the mental footsteps of previous Austrian economists, many critics apply these outdated frameworks to attack Bitcoin. Niels van der Leyden, one of the first Bitcoin skeptics, when a Bitcoin was 77 cents, rejected Bitcoin for this very reason. He claimed it would not work because, quote, nobody could do anything with them but trade them. Therefore, he concluded they had no use as commodities and would not work as money. While commodity and fiat monies were the only two possibilities for early Austrian economists outside of credit instruments, times have changed. In our digital age, the distinction between commodity and fiat money has lost its value. It should be immediately apparent that Bitcoin does not fit neatly into this dichotomy. It has no use as a physical commodity, but also does not exist through any legal decree. We can now hold and trade digital money wholly independent of the simple force of law. Instead, Bitcoin's monetary properties are guaranteed with rules and logic embedded into its coded DNA. Through this purely digital existence, Bitcoin lives as a money free from the restraints of the physical world. Solving the hard money paradox. In fact, if the skeptics had done their homework, they would realize that Mises was a Bitcoiner at heart as well. He recognized the problems inherent in commodity money, but saw gold as the best of bad choices. In The Theory of Money and Credit, Mises laments that even a monetary system based on gold is still subject to, quote, considerable disadvantages regarding, quote, not only the fluctuations in the supply of money and the demand for it, but also fluctuations in the conditions of production of the metal and variations in the industrial demand for it. End quote. Mises correctly points out that commodity uses of money create price distortions as fluctuating industrial demands push and pull on the shared supply. Hard money has always been associated with unique physical attributes, good for money, but also other industries. In this regard, gold's incredible versatility across many different industries magnifies this harmful effect. The physical world also brings other monetary restraints. Something found in nature cannot be routinely distributed over time. Here, Bitcoin's predictable periodic emission allows for supply calculations decades into the future that are not possible outside the digital world. A physical item supply also cannot be audited. At any moment, someone could find previously unknown amounts of gold and radically dilute ownership without current holders knowing about the sudden changes in supply. Similar to how cowrie shells were secretly inflated by European traders to the detriment of African tribes. With Bitcoin's digital nature, anyone can audit the entire supply and know the exact amount created at any time. With these advances, it's silly to cling to the Austrian economists giving advice for their unique historical moment. Those writers were not laying down universal constants. Even they realized their limits and hoped for better forms of money than precious metals. New circumstances require new theoretical foundations, and Bitcoin gives us just that. Bitcoin as the key to unlocking captured utility. In our present day, it just so happens that the best stores of value are also those that have some element of utility as a commodity. The key distinction here is that gold, real estate, or any form of commodity money is not a store of value because of its utility as a commodity, but despite that utility. When someone decides to hold gold or any other asset for a monetary purpose, they make a clear and conscious choice to use it for its wealth storage properties instead of as a useful commodity. Rather than creating electronics parts or jewelry, holding a gold bar puts gold's monetary properties to work. While this decision may appear innocuous, this can bring harmful economic consequences. Large numbers of people storing their value in a specific commodity with hopes of wealth storage often leads to extreme waste and speculative bubbles. Real estate is a particularly egregious example of this effect. Today, speculators chase, quote, golden concrete to protect their wealth. Developer Michael Stern explains, quote, the global elite is basically looking for a safe deposit box, end quote. And many have decided to invest in Manhattan properties to store their funds. By doing this, they are using their luxury apartments for saving instead of for living. As a result, journalists noted, quote, according to the Census Bureau, throughout a sweeping stretch of Midtown, from 49th to 70th Streets, between 5th Avenue and Park, nearly one in three apartments is completely empty at least 10 months a year, end quote. Similar trends are spreading through large cities worldwide. As The Guardian reports, quote, the trend for the world's super rich to invest in prime London property as a way to safeguard their wealth without the need to secure a rental income has meant the number of empty homes in Kensington and Chelsea rose 22.7% over the same period and 8.5% since 2015, end quote. As the elite continue to pour wealth into these commodities, bubbles begin to rise to the top. A recent report by UBS shows just how risky this has become. Not only are properties sitting empty, using homes as a significant store of wealth destroys healthy market incentives for new housing development. San Francisco and the rest of the California housing market are obvious examples of this phenomena. Below is a map illustrating San Francisco's zoning regulations. All areas shaded yellow are limited to a building height of 40 feet. Figure 2, a map of San Francisco's local zoning laws. These regulations are a clear impediment to building new affordable housing to meet demand. Given the repercussions on the average residents and rent prices, why do they exist? One large cause stems from existing homeowners lobbying for artificial restrictions on supply to preserve their wealth. A recent report by the Legislative Analyst's Office for California noted that, quote, residents may see new housing as a threat to their financial well-being. For many homeowners, their home is their most significant financial investment. Existing homeowners, therefore, may be inclined to limit new housing because they fear it will reduce the values of their homes, end quote. Because the average buyer does not have a reliable store of value in their money, homes are considered by many to be the best place to safeguard one's wealth. This naturally causes homeowners to then lobby to constrict home supply so their precarious wealth is not diluted. In this sense, the real estate markets only have store of value properties through artificially generating scarcity. Bitcoin would not solve this problem entirely, but it gives potential home buyers an alternative way to securely store wealth over time. Allowing people to rethink their financial decisions may ease the pressure against building new homes. With new affordable development, cities would be able to increase their density and improve the quality of life for all residents. For example, research modeling suggests that if San Francisco were able to increase its housing density, this could significantly reduce the city's carbon footprint, increase the city's walkability, and improve the quality of community life, all while preserving the signature sunny California environment. Tweet by Peter Schiff. The ultimate irony in the Drop Gold campaign is that you can't mine Bitcoin without using gold. This is just one of the many utilities of gold that Bitcoin promoters deny exist. But while they overlook gold's obvious utility, they ascribe utility to Bitcoin where none exists. End tweet. Gold is another great example. As individuals sell their gold to buy bitcoins, gold that was previously held for its wealth storage properties can be put to work in electronics, medical devices, and aerospace suits. It can even be eaten. Gold stored around the world can be used to benefit society through cheaper and higher quality products and make previously impossible endeavors much more affordable. With Bitcoin, we can actually afford to go to the moon. So when you hear gold bugs extol its amazing societal uses, they are right, but they are really making a case for digital gold. By acting as a global store of value, Bitcoin unlocks that stored commodity utility that we've had to set aside because our world has always lacked a pure money. Final thoughts. Instead of locking up useful resources to store wealth, Bitcoin gives humans the ability to store wealth free from the opportunity cost inherent in storing commodities. This global, permanent, and accessible store of wealth is forming a solid bedrock for future economies around the world. As funds move from other asset classes towards Bitcoin, this newfound supply will create better access for affordable housing, rejuvenated urban environments, higher quality consumer goods, and more. Yes, Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, and for that, we should be thankful. A special thanks to Karina Kaufman, Dan Held, and the Bitcoin Observer for their incredible help. All right. And that concludes Connor Brown's article. Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, and that's great. We are going to hit our sponsor real quick, and we will jump right back in because I want to talk about this piece. This hits so many of the great points that I've been arguing for a long time, and I was really happy. I'm really happy that this got shared again so that I bumped into it and actually got a chance to read it. All right, so let's hit our sponsor, and I'll be right back. All right, guys. So again, that was by Connor Brown, and it was titled Bitcoin Has No Intrinsic Value, and That Is Great. So there's a lot of stuff I want to hit in this. First off, I just want to say I got about the voice messages at Anchor. I'm actually thinking about doing like a Q&A for like patrons and supporting listeners, which, by the way, Anchor has, I didn't even realize and I wasn't making use of, but they have a supporting listeners section of Anchor where you can just go up and you can donate like $1 a month or $5 a month or something and just be a supporting listener. So that would be a great, I'm actually going to try to take more advantage of that. So if you really enjoyed this show and you want to be a supporting listener, that's a really, really great way to do that. Also, I'm thinking about doing like a monthly Q&A or something where you guys can submit questions. And I think the voicemail thing or the voice messages that Anchor has just built in might be a really, really good way to do that. So I'm really excited about that, and I want to see you guys try it out. So leave me some voice messages or whatever, whether it be a comment or a question or anything about the show, because I want to kind of dig into and explore that. Maybe I'll send myself a voice message in the meantime just to start playing around with it. Okay, so this article, there's a lot of stuff I want to hit. I really, really love this article. This is a topic and really an argument that I've been making for quite some time that is still incredibly rare. I still constantly hear people trying to defend that Bitcoin has intrinsic value or that Bitcoin needs intrinsic value. And I think it's a misnomer. It's a misdirection from what the real story is here. It's a distraction from what's actually important. First, it was he basically, Connor basically starts out with the, in a sense, a pseudo Mises regression theorem idea that the value of money must, and mostly because it just has been in the past, must start as value for some other reason or utility. So in the case of the argument that he laid out here, and which is very, very common, that it must be a commodity used for some other reason. Like, you know, gold is used in jewelry and electronics, which I think right off the start there, like the fact that anybody says electronics, like you're immediately like, no, like electronics are brand new. Like you can't, gold wasn't money 3,000 years ago because of electronics. So that's already out the window, but we'll just say jewelry or because you can use it as a metal and like a tool or something like that. That then people naturally stockpiled it as a store of value. But I think this entire argument goes out the window because it's just saying that it must obtain value in some way before it can be used as a money, as a store of value. So I think this entire argument is completely out the window and completely irrelevant to discussion the second that Bitcoin obtained a price. Like, When Laszlo bought two pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin, that was it. That was done. That entire criticism was settled. But we'll get back to that in a minute. I do want to go into that a little bit deeper, but let's hit the other points before we get to it. So first, I take issue with the idea of intrinsic value. Like Connor says, value is subjective. Nothing has intrinsic value. Gold does not have intrinsic value. There's no logical reason to value something shiny over something dull and boring. It's just something that people do as human nature. So the concept of jewelry is completely frivolous and subjective. Like, you're not actually more valuable because you have some shiny shit around your neck than somebody who doesn't. Like, so even actual practical value, like I can use this for some task, is not an intrinsic value. 200 years ago, if a farmer had oil spraying out of their ground, it was killing their crops, it completely destroyed the value of their land, they would just lose everything in their investment for the farm. They'd have to sell the farm for pennies on the dollar. 100 years later, they would have been sitting on $1 billion, exclusive access to an oil reserve. But the fact that you could use oil for that was not intrinsic. Like it's not, like that value was not intrinsic. It was only because someone knew and could communicate and knew how to make use of it and desired to make use of it that it actually had any value. The farmer doesn't care that in 100 years cars are going to run on oil. Like that doesn't That's not intrinsic value. Same with gold. It's only how we can use it that it makes any sense as value. Again, subjective, specific to the person involved in the transaction or in its actual use. So the idea that something has intrinsic value is entirely dependent on the person making use of it, their knowledge, and what they actually want to use it for. And we're talking about tools here. There are many, many tools in the world, and some of them that are specifically good just at very, very abstract goals, like networking people or organizing trade and agreement, or are making something trustworthy versus not, like doing a trade in a public square as opposed to secretly behind a building or something. Like, these things have value. These are technically tools. The idea of organizing people into a business is a tool. It's a very specific tool. And if you tweak it wrong, it doesn't work. Like, the hierarchies in how to organize people, a flat architecture versus a hierarchical one. We have constant modifications and evolutions of these tools, but these are tools nonetheless. In that same vein, money is one of those tools. Like, the reason people adopt money or they adopt a language is the exact same reason that they adopt something like a certain type of organizing a business or a certain type of agreement between two people or make an agreement in a certain way or with a or in a certain place. Like, these things get adopted because they are useful tools, whether they are ethereal and abstract or concrete and very specific. So a money simply has to be a certain set of characteristics that make it useful in the role as that tool. If it can also be used for something else, it's mostly irrelevant. Or as Connor argues, and I agree, it's potentially a negative. So like, why on earth do we want the value of money to have some lopsided shift in price based on, you know, specifically the market of electronics rather than every market all at once? Like, it's a good money because it's universal. If you know, half of its use is in electronics and the electronics market has a swing, well, then it becomes a bad money for corn while the electronics market is in fluctuation. You want a money is useful as that tool because it's universal, and I think the fact that it isn't used for other things is a benefit. Just like Connor says, it has no intrinsic value outside of its use as money, and that's a good thing. That makes it a better tool of money, not a worse tool as money. So if a commodity or tool or system or whatever it is, if it can be used for two separate things, we're only talking about the affecting of its overall value, not whether or not it's useful for one thing versus the other. Like a hammer. A hammer is a tool that the subjective value is that you can use it to set nails, but you can also use it to pry out nails. If you separate those two jobs, you can still have one that only sets nails and one that only pries out nails. If your hammer can't set nails, that doesn't mean that now you can't use it to pry out nails. Like, you can buy a nail pry and you can buy a two-sided hammer that doesn't pry anything out. So the overall value is affected by the fact that it has multiple roles, but any individual value has nothing to do with its use as a different tool. Like, I can also use a hammer as a paperweight or a doorstop. Like, there's a lot of other things I can do with it that are unimportant, typically to, you know, the use of a hammer. But it might prevent me from buying a paperweight if I've got a hammer lying around. So the fact that we can use gold for jewelry or we can make it into metal or electronics does not have any value or does not have any effect on its value as a money. It is a good money regardless of whether or not you could easily use it for those other things. And in fact, again, the argument would be that those things actually create an unbalanced skew of its price as a money because it's being used up in a market that is not its monetary value. But its monetary premium is easily the vast majority of its value. And it only needed to carry a penny's worth of price for it to start being used as a good money, for it to, it only needed to obtain a price in order to, for its all of its other characteristics to suddenly be very useful as a tool of money. Another good example is for like a tool that we think of that has no intrinsic value, yet people adopt all the time and obviously have immense value, is something like a protocol. And I mean protocol as in a language. TCP/IP is a good example. But like just saying hello when we answer the phone, shaking someone's hand when you first meet them, agreeing to use TCP/IP specifically to route packets on the internet, the English language, the Chinese language, all of these things have immense value, even though they cannot carry a direct price and they do not have the scarcity that makes them a good money. They don't have the exchangeability. So they can't operate in the process of market pricing and market exchange. If I give you the English language, like if I teach you English, I don't lose English. Like I'm not giving you my English and then you can give it to somebody else. We both have it at the end of that quote-unquote exchange. So it's not something that can hold value despite the fact that it has immense value. Okay, so the first thing that Connor actually, after like hitting the main points on like why we don't want, like why Bitcoin actually doesn't have any intrinsic value, its value is the fact that it is a well-designed money. It's kind of like, why does this persist? Why does this idea persist that there is such thing as intrinsic value, which there isn't? Value is, again, subjective and ordinal, as Rothbard puts it. It's you can only relate value to something else. There is no objective, like, measurement. There's no, like core piece of value where we can just add all the values together and get total value of something. You only have the value of a second egg is only in relation to the first egg that you already have, where the value of the first egg is the fact that you don't have any eggs already. Each one is valued completely differently because you can only evaluate it against alternatives. It's only relative. But the main reason, I think, that this persists, and Connor hits in his first main section, is the appeal to history. That this is how it happened last time, so obviously this is how it's going to happen again. And this is almost universally just when we're talking about gold and silver and major metals that were used for something else, but then became the dominant forms of money. But I think this is just ignoring, as he said, I mean, he brings up the glass beads that you can read about in Shelling Out, the origins of money, the rhizestones. There are plenty of examples in history in which this is wrong, that obviously it did not have to be a commodity that was used for something else. And there's a huge number of these. Seashells and glass beads have both been used as money for centuries in various areas across the world because mostly that they were hard to obtain, so they couldn't be easily inflated. And history shows that when like the English or the Spanish, like when the European countries were expanding across the world, they would run into these civilizations and then find out that they could just make glass beads or seashells, et cetera, and then suddenly those tools that worked as money locally in those areas didn't work as soon as you start branching out into completely different communities that had no attachment to it. The English would make glass beads and then take them to like the coast of Africa and spend them like crazy, and over a period of like 50 or 70 years, glass beads became crap money. Like they basically inflated out of existence because the English could very easily and very quickly make glass beads, and they had no attachment to its use as money outside of the fact that they could go get a bunch of stuff and then, you know, return to England and use them. So yap stones, the rhizestones are such a good example. And the rhizestones were used for centuries. It was like it's arguable because there's not a really solid history, but there were some like flat stones that they think could have been rhizestones or precursors to rhizestones and used as money even like 2,000 or more years ago. But the predominant use of the iconic, the circular rhizestone with the hole in the middle was a 400 to 500 year period. I mean, I think it started in like 1000 AD. I don't remember. I haven't read up on that in a while. But this is four to 500 years that this was a currency. Like, this was the dominant money. Rhizestones are useful for nothing else. They're not jewelry. Like, we're talking about stones that weighed many tons. You couldn't eat them. They had absolutely no commodity use. They were just giant stones. And the truth is that the reason, one of the things that made it such a good money was that you couldn't do anything else with it, was that you couldn't move it. Somebody couldn't steal it. So their ownership was just a matter of public record. And the rhizestones were the points on the ledger. So you could exchange them easily because you didn't have to move them. I would just, for me to give you a rhizestone right now, if we just had one in the yard somewhere, it would just, I would just be telling the tribe or whatever that I don't own this rhizestone anymore. I have now given it to you. And that was it. So it was incredibly portable because you didn't have to move the rhizestone anywhere. You just had to tell the other people that this person now owned the rhizestone. Like, arguably, the rhizestones and like the money on Yap Islands was the first digital money. Like, and again, that for centuries that worked until basically they were conquered. So I think in that way, history does not actually support the commodity argument. History supports the fact that it does not have to be a commodity, even though some of the dominant monies were in fact commodities that were useful for some other reason. But history shows that both goods that could be a commodity or that could be used for some other reason, and goods that have absolutely no other purpose, as long as they have a certain set of characteristics, both could be and have been money in the past. And then this leads right into the whole appeals to authority idea that, you know, we have all these economic theories and, you know, we can't be challenging these economic theories because, you know, they're based on, you know, Rothbard or Mises or whatever, which, I don't think Mises' regression theorem is being challenged. Like, there's a lot of people who think because you've got the regression theorem that obviously Bitcoin cannot be money. And as I said earlier, like, the fact that Bitcoin ever pulled a price, I think, completely fits the regression. I don't even think Mises is wrong, even though he was using it in the context of explaining gold. I don't think the theory is wrong at all. It has to pull a price for some other reason, be it a collectible, which Bitcoin was just this fun digital point that people were playing around with, and because it was scarce, it obtained a price. And I think that was the end of it. Like, that's all it needed to fulfill that economic theory, and I think it did. But the one thing we can know is that if it doesn't have any of the good characteristics of money, it doesn't matter if it has any other value. It has to have, all it has to have is these seven or so characteristics that make it a good money for it to be a good money. And I think the idea that having another utility, and this is the reason why I was really happy and really, really enjoyed this article, was it was the core argument that having some other utility unrelated to money was actually a drawback. And it wasn't until I discovered Bitcoin and started asking that question and reading a lot more about the history of money and all of the dominant theories around money that I began to have that idea about it and kind of falling into that camp. I'm not sure if I heard it specifically somewhere else or if it was just something that, like, while my brother and I were going back and forth, we just started, like, it kind of just fell into place. But it was one that, like, I've thought for a very long time, and I don't hear many other people talk about that, a utility outside, something that is moving the value more than whether or not it's a good money, is actually a bad thing for its use as a money. But I actually want to dedicate more of a, I almost want to dedicate a whole episode to this, because I think it falls really into line with the whole inflationary money versus deflationary money argument. And I think I think you can't really disconnect those two things. So I actually want to hit that more specifically, probably in a guy's take later on in the week. But I really like that, because I think something that Connor brought up in the article will be very, very pertinent to this discussion, but I don't want to go into it yet. But that's about how, like, because money started sucking, like, because the dollar began to get abused in its role as a store of value and no longer serves that purpose of holding value over time, that suddenly people started removing actual resources and real, like, extremely valuable resources from the economy, like housing. And now we have a bunch of houses sitting completely empty while at the exact same time we have a very big homeless problem. Like, I think those things are not only not separate, they're deeply connected. And I really want to hit that topic in more thought and in more detail, but I don't want to do it on this episode. I like Connor's introduction to that, and we will leave that right where it is. And we'll come back to it later. But basically, my final thoughts on this is that I think the major reason that this is so misunderstood and that people want to hold to ideas that they already have is just because people get trapped in mental categorizations. Like, as soon as we say this thing is a commodity, this thing is physical, this thing is software, this is blah, et cetera, we forget that these distinctions are totally made up. And it's because they are useful in understanding and figuring out how we can apply those things. It's not that the categories are wrong, but it is that those categories are made up distinctions. Everything is gray area. There are no strict, solid lines like there are between categories in anything in the natural world. Like, I mean, think about it. Like just fruits and vegetables. Red peppers and cucumbers are fruits. A watermelon is technically a berry. But when we get stuck to these categorizations, we think of that as being silly. And the category actually, like, these are our distinctions, not nature's distinctions. So they stop being useful sometimes. And we have to go back and just describe and think about the purpose or the use of some of these things, or we're actually going to lead to confusion rather than clarity, much like thinking about a cucumber. And obviously any person who associates with all that stuff, you think cucumber is a vegetable. No, it's actually a fruit. But in the same way, the mistake of separating the value of physical things versus the value of abstract or virtual things is simply an error based on the nature of scarcity and the fact that one has it and one does not. But it does not mean that they both don't have value. It means that they cannot both, only one of them can actually behave as a store of value because it can be exchanged. When one person has it, the other person does not, and vice versa. A abstract or like a software or an idea or information, they have immense value, but you cannot exchange those things. I can't give you my knowledge of Bitcoin and then not retain my knowledge of Bitcoin. I can't just like tell myself to forget all of these things and then I'll give it to you and you will have it and I won't. Like, that's not how it works. It's infinitely replicable. A language is such a good example of this because it's almost impossible to measure the value of a language, but it's obviously immensely valuable. It's a protocol to organize our movements, our thoughts, like our information and knowledge, events that we are doing. And if you don't share a language, it's the most frustrating thing in the world. It feels like you can't accomplish anything. Obviously, the efficiency boost from sharing a language is orders of magnitude more valuable than the complexity and the frustration and the headache of not sharing a language. So, but again, it's not a commodity only because there is one very specific characteristic that it doesn't have. And it's the nature of something that's abstract. It's something that exists specifically in our minds. But therein lies the brilliance of Bitcoin as a monetary instrument. It is the first tool to ever bridge the immense value of a virtual thing like a language, but actually being able to recreate the one attribute of the physical world it needs to be a good, like to be an actual money. Scarcity. The digital world already had all of the other characteristics of great money without even trying. A digital point is always fungible with another digital point. You can't tell where it came from. Digital everything is infinitely durable. You can copy it and make sure you don't delete it. And if you have it today versus on a computer in 1,000 years, well, you know, we'll see what happens when we get there. But obviously, the digital information is no different unless you actually change it. It can be the exact same thing. You know, you used to have it on a floppy disk, then you transfer it to a CD, then you put it on a USB stick. Now it's in your cloud server, like, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then obviously it's divisible, it's recognizable, like all the other things that a good money needs are all there in the digital space. But the one thing that wasn't possible is the ability to exchange something digital without retaining your own copy. Everything digital was infinitely replicable. And you had no way to prove, you had no way to verify that it wasn't. So despite the trillions, the literal trillions of dollars in value as software, designs and organizational systems, management, like concepts, languages, protocols, cryptography, all of these things that make up digital communications and how we organize and operate, coordinate each other to accomplish some sort of goal. The one thing that none of those things could actually recreate was scarcity. It wasn't possible in the abstract. Bitcoin changed that. And even better, Bitcoin managed to obtain that without taking any of the other ridiculous restrictions and complications of a physical good. So it doesn't have to be carried around. If you have 1 million Bitcoin versus 1 Bitcoin, it's not any heavier. Like all of the annoying things about a physical good have not been replicated, and it has managed to take only the scarcity, the one thing it needs to be exchangeable and to carry value across time from today to 2 months from now, and do so very, very well, in fact. So it's our own little mental boxes that we put the world in that blind us to the fact that there are thin or invisible lines, really, between things that we just put in different categories. And we think of them as having vast differences, but they're actually very closely related. Like a TCP connection, a smile, and a handshake. Like these things might look different, but they are tools for the same purpose. So in a similar way, Bitcoin is a digital good that brought that one thing, scarcity, into the digital world where it did not seem possible before. And because of that, Bitcoin is now the greatest money that has ever existed. And it's not because it has intrinsic value, it's because it has immense subjective value, and it can organize people and facilitate trade on a level that has never been possible with any other money before. And it can do it without the abuse and the corruption that comes with authoritative money, or the immense inefficiency of a centrally controlled money that allows its issuer to essentially do whatever it wants and confiscate economic resources for its goals against the goals of those who are supposed to be in control or the rightful owner of that money. So it's a complete paradigm shift, and it's better than gold. It's absolutely 100% better than gold. The only time that it could ever not be better than gold is if somehow it lost its scarcity. And because that is the one attribute that makes the difference. And Bitcoin is more scarce than gold. So I think this was just a wonderful article. I love this topic. I always have. And a huge thank you to Connor Brown. Go to his Medium page and drop some serious applause on this one. And don't forget to share it out. And from what I mentioned earlier on, do not forget to throw out your input on whether or not you think I should rebrand, if it makes sense to do that for this show. And also J.W. Weatherman's the bounty for the Bitcoin Attackers Wiki, I think that's what they called it, which is kind of funny. I like that. I'll be sure to link to his Twitter page and 10hoursofbitcoin.com so that you can go there and see that very easily. It's just donate down at the bottom of the page. So if you would like to donate to that project, that's always a good place to put a little Bitcoin to help defend the newbies from the people who would wish to do Bitcoin harm or just have no care in the world that they did some very terrible and almost disastrous things in the past and think that they're not going to have to answer for that. So that could be a really fun project, and I hope you choose to donate. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. We will close this episode out here, and I will catch you back tomorrow with another really fun article. It's probably going to be a two-part, and it's by Hayek, and we're going to talk about the use of knowledge in society and the fallacy that if we had one super smart genius person, that he could set all the prices and figure out all the things that allow the economy to work efficiently, and that would be highly preferable to a system where everybody is making their own decisions. So it's going to be a fun one. And I will catch you back here tomorrow. In the meantime, don't forget to drop me a voice message if you've got a comment or a question. And if you would like to be a supporter of this show, that would be wonderful. And you can go to anchor.fm/thecryptoeconomy and easily become a supporter of the show. You don't even have to register, though, just so that I can pick out one user from another. I would actually prefer that you did that. Makes it easy for me to, you know, send messages or know who I'm talking to. But of course, you do not have to. If you want to just, you know, donate randomly, you can easily just sign up and become a listener right from that page. And it is at the bottom of the show notes of every single episode. So if you would like to do that and support this show ongoing into the future, that would be wonderful. And I would thank you so, so, so much. But until next time, this has been the Crypto Economy Podcast. I am Guy Swan signing off. We got another episode coming at you tomorrow. And until then, take it easy, guys.